At Kelly Companies, it is no secret that they believe in the power of people. In an effort to help their Kellyans get to know each other a little bit better, they decided to launch the Who Do You Know campaign. The goal was simple. Kellyans were encouraged to have a conversation with someone outside of their circle. That's it. These conversations, however, have brought people together and furthered their world-class culture. Shout out to the Kellyans who have made an effort to have meaningful conversations with new friends. You can learn more about those conversations, about those amazing friends, by visiting them online at KeelyCompanies.com.
Welcome to the Live Inspired podcast with John O'Leary. John is the number one national best-selling author of the book On Fire. He's a world-class inspirational speaker, and he's the host of the Live Inspired podcast. John interviews extraordinary individuals on their life story so that you can wake up from accidental living and more fully live your life story. Here's your host, John O'Leary.
Well, hello, my friends, and welcome to the Live Inspired podcast with John O'Leary. The gentleman that you are about to meet today is undoubtedly a radiant symbol of possibility. You're going to love this guy. You're going to love his heart. You're going to love his story. You're going to love what he's doing with his life. And what he's reminding you through that is possible in your life. All right, dude, that's a pretty big setup, O'Leary. Where are you taking us today? Well, let me tell you. Born into poverty in 1959 in the Jim Crow South, our guest today, his name is Jimmy James, was one of eight children raised by a devoted single mother. He came from extraordinarily humble beginnings and from an early age decided that he would be the very first person he knew to graduate high school. That doesn't mean just the first person in his family, although that's true. The first person on his neighborhood block, which was also true. He'd never met anyone who'd graduated high school. This dream was only the beginning as he then soared through college and launched into a transformative 33-year career at ExxonMobil. It's an amazing story. Even how he got the job is stunning. His climb from an entry-level engineer to a globe-trotting executive proved that where you begin does not dictate at all where you end up. And as he transitioned into retirement, my friend Jimmy decided that he would lace up some golf shoes and set out on a new adventure. What was the adventure? How about this? Playing all of Golf Digest 100 top courses in America within a single year. It had never been done before. My friends, today's episode is not about golf. Jimmy's going to share his remarkable journey as he teaches us about persistence, about unshakable determination, about breaking barriers, about coming together, and about the power of chasing our dreams and changing not only our life, but the lives of those who come behind us. My friends, this conversation, like I mentioned, is more than golf or overcoming adversity. It is a beautiful reminder to you to keep swinging, keep dreaming, and keep believing that anything is possible. So without further ado, let me bring him onto the show. His name is Jimmy James. Jimmy James, welcome to Live Inspired with John O'Leary.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate the opportunity to share my story.
Well, what a story worthy of sharing, man. And we always chat with our guests before we officially hit record. And already I know this is going to be an awesome conversation between two friends. So I'm looking forward to sharing this with our larger friend group tuning in from around the country and around the world. But if you were to meet them, maybe at a tee box, okay, right before you drive off on one for the first shot of the match, and they say, Jimmy, tell me about you. How would you respond to that?
I'd say I was born in the deepest woods of East Texas during the late Jim Crow era to a single mother who had three other kids at the time and would go on to have four more. I was a middle child, born into poverty at the age of five. I set a goal to become the first person, essentially the first person I knew to graduate from high school. I went through school, got to college, and then went into a career in the oil and gas industry. Rose from entry-level engineer to executive and retired. And along the way, discovered that life is found at the intersection of aspirations and adversity. That when your biggest hopes and dreams come up against your biggest challenges, what you do at that moment is what ends up defining you. And so throughout my life, from an early age all the way through, well, you know, into adulthood, into today, as challenges arise, I'm that person that tries to find the pathway to get beyond it. I'm defined, I think, today more so by what I've overcome than by how my life started. My birth certificate, when I saw it for the first time, it was really disheartening. And you see it when you go to school, you have to have your birth certificate.
Yes.
And to see a piece of paper that says that you don't legally exist. I didn't know, you know, the word is a big word back then, but my birth certificate has illegitimate.
Yeah.
And in the 60s, we were colored. So I was born colored and illegitimate and to a single mother. And for the longest time, that was what defined me. And so overcoming things in life is now what defines me, what I've overcome more so than what I was born into.
What a story. And I can't wait to slowly peel back the onion of the various layers you just laid out for us from that birth certificate where they checked two boxes, colored and illegitimate, to the journey forward that has led you to be on this podcast. And it is a wild ride. So I'm humbled, Jimmy. I'm honored to have you on our show. So let's start with your mom. There are many heroes that people are going to learn about in your story. Some were with you for a lifetime. Others were with you for about 18 holes. But there are so many heroes in your story, none mightier than your beautiful mom. Just talk about this woman for a little bit. Talk about her life.
My mother, and some of these things I only learned after she passed away. But I'll back up for a moment and tell you, and we'll talk about both of these. But when I was doing the recording for the audiobook, the two most challenging places in the book to get through were talking about my mother's funeral and burial. That one, and then another one that we'll talk about that I think has some commonality between you and me. But who she was, what she represented, and what she did. You know, I was talking to my wife last night about this. I said, my siblings and I, all eight of us, grew up in poverty, but not a single one of us spent a single moment as an adult in poverty. Mm. My mother raised by herself, essentially, eight kids to be productive, contributing citizens in society. She didn't get a lot of praise for it when we were young. She got criticized for her approach to parenting, the level of independence she gave us, and by family members, by neighbors. There's a part in the book where I talk about, you know, where I was born, we were born around prisons. We were Huntsville, Texas. It's the prison capital of the state. I'm not sure there's another place in the country that has as many prisons as are gathered around Huntsville. But they would say to my mother, Thelma, those children going to break your heart. They're going to end up in the pen. And my mother's response every time was, you take care of yours and I'll take care of mine. And the way she took care of us was the example she set for us. She never said a bad thing about anyone. Her rules were simple. Her principles, she was strong and true to her principles. And they were very simple principles. Don't lie. Don't steal. Don't talk bad about other people. Don't talk bad about your siblings or anyone else. The thing that I also remember most about her is she was undeterred by any challenge. I never heard her once ever complain about anything. And it could be something as simple as when we eventually lived in a house that had running water. For us, if the sink plugged up, you couldn't wash the dishes. No, you just get a pan, a tub, and put it in the sink, run water in it, and wash the dishes there. Whether it is a simple challenge or a great challenge, not having shoes to wear to go to school, but still going to school, you figure out a way to get through it. And that comes from my mother. She imparted that into all 8 of our children. And it made a difference in our lives. Just that, don't give up, don't quit, just figure out a way.
I've been fortunate to meet a whole lot of folks through the work that we do. And a lot of them talk about how unprivileged their childhood was, because mine was radically blessed, man. 2 parents, safe neighborhood, running water, shoes on both feet, the good life. Like, we really had an awesome upbringing in my world. And then these folks talk about how unfair theirs was. And they're right. It was totally different than mine. And then I read your story about the way you were raised without the shoes on the way to school. A few other things that I took note of. You did not have running water in your house for a while. The food that you prepared was either caught or grown, usually yourself. It was cooked on a wood-burning stove. Heat on cold days was generated by burning wood chopped by your own hands, on and on and on. So I just want our listeners and our viewers to know, on the front side of this, man, this was not an easy upbringing at a very difficult time societally to be an African-American boy in East Texas. Did you know how difficult your life was? Did you take a look around and say, man, this isn't right? This isn't fair.
I don't think I ever said this isn't right or this isn't fair. I knew instinctively that there had to be an easier way, but it was outside that world that I'd get that understanding, because inside that world, while we were the poorest of all the families, everybody else was poor also. And it just seemed, that's what normal seemed like. But I knew that there was another normal. And that's where deciding that I was going to graduate from high school, I didn't know what separated those that had, or them from us, but I thought I'd give it a shot through. I knew no one around me had graduated from high school. So that must have had something to do with our condition, our state, why things were more challenging for us than it appeared for others. And so that's where the desire to get an education, to graduate from high school, came in. But you alluded to it. I mean, to me, it was just normal back then that what we ate, we either grew, raised, or trapped. And then, I mean, it's unimaginable now to think about some of the things we ate: raccoons, possums, squirrels, robins, birds. Because robins, you'd eat the breast, and the breast was the biggest part, of course, of the bird. But that was life. That was normal. Eating those types of things, today, I think about it and my stomach would turn. But back then, it was just normal.
Right. So you mentioned in your book that you had no family who graduated high school. You had no neighbors. You didn't know a single person growing up who graduated high school. So then who is inspiring you to achieve? Like, who are the mentors as a young boy that you're looking up to saying, well, if she can do it or that person can do it, man, I'm capable.
Yeah, so there are two pieces to that. One is I knew that there was a different life, because when we leave either the country, when we lived in the country, or what was called the Selma quarters, when we lived in the Selma quarters, when we ventured outside that, you'd see this different world with different people with different lives. And also, our mother worked in the home of the town whites, and they had much better lives. The pecking order in what was the sawmill quarters was on full display. At the top of the hill was the company store for the sawmill. And the houses around it were all painted houses with sheetrocked walls, electricity, plumbing, natural gas. Then you move down the hill a little bit, and there was one street that the Mexicans lived on that had come to Huntsville with the mill owner when he shut down his business near Houston, Texas. And then below that, and they had shacks, tin roof shacks like ours, but they had natural gas that was piped into those. And then you get down to the blacks, or the coloreds, as we were called back then. And there were just shacks with no plumbing, no electricity, no natural gas. And so you could see that even within that small sawmill community, there were better lives for people that weren't Black. And then you go into town and you'd see the lives. So there was a knowledge, even at that young age, of the differences and a desire for a different type of life. And that was really the motivation initially was just an internal type of motivation that inspired me to want to do something, to be something different, to do something different. But as I got into school, some of my heroes, of course, were teachers who some of the ones I remember most were Miss Thompson in fourth grade, my fourth grade math teacher, who said, your math ability is faster than the pace we're moving. Why don't you come to my house on Saturdays and we can do some advanced modules so that you can move ahead of the rest of the class? Then I was sixth grade. I had my first Black male teacher, Mr. Calvin. And then in Playing from the Rough, I write that Mr. Calvin was sort of, if there had been Black role models on television at the time, they'd look like him.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a tall, handsome guy with Black hair streak, gray streaks on the side, just well-mannered, well-spoken. And in his math class, math came to life for me. It wasn't just numbers on a page. It was, there were problems that you could solve. And I'd create a pretend life through math. And so those teachers played a huge role throughout my early life.
You had in your book a social worker who played a role, but not necessarily a positive one. You were telling her what you dreamed of doing, that you dreamed of going on to high school, that you dreamed radically enough of going on to university and getting a job corporately. And she was trying to encourage you to tap your brakes on that.
Yeah. For 3 years, we lived in the projects in this little town, Hitchcock, Texas, across the bridge from Galveston, Texas, along the Gulf Coast. We lived at these projects called The Village, all poor people living there. And the social worker would come once a month or so just to check on the kids to make sure they weren't being abused and would meet with us individually in private. And when she asked me about my dreams and I told her that I wanted to travel around the world as a businessman, she said, you know, it's really good to have dreams. That's a good thing, but your dreams need to be realistic. So if you were to just be able to graduate from high school and get a job at one of the plants, one of the refineries or chemical plants in the area, you will have beat the odds. And she was well-meaning, and I listened politely and just ignored it. And that's where I also talk in the book with one of the caddies that I played with, where I said, you can't allow other people to allow their limitations to define what your life, what you're capable of. Others shouldn't be defining what someone else is capable of. And so I didn't allow that to deter me. And I knew that my dreams were bigger than what she could understand was possible for me.
So I hear you sharing these stories, and I can imagine your little younger version of yourself running to school barefoot and then returning to a waterless, smoke-infested, rat-infested, difficult house, difficult life, man. And yet your voice is just packed with joy. And I'm curious, where's your anger? Where's your resentment?
I don't know that there should be anger. We're talking about, Playing from the Rough is a braiding of two stories. My life journey and my golf journey. And those are two things, like people think golf is supposed to be easy. That's a wrong expectation, I think.
I've never thought golf was supposed to be easy.
Some people think it's supposed to be easy. Golf is hard. And it's supposed to be hard. It's okay that it's hard. You know, life itself, life isn't easy. It's not supposed to be hard or easy. It just is. And one of the things that I think my mother helped us understand, and I came to understand even more so in my early adult life when I read a book by this Hungarian American psychologist, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, about flow and the idea that we should be fixated on what we have rather than lamenting the things that we don't have. And that's something that, again, from my mother, she never complained about anything. One of the things I'd say, and I didn't say this in the book, but that I verbalize here is, in America, even when I lived in poverty, every day of my life was somebody's dream somewhere else in the world. I mean, let that sink in. Every day of my life, regardless of the conditions, someone somewhere in the world would consider that a dream life.
Man, I'm going to hover over that for a moment because a lot of folks right now in this nation and in other nations don't believe that. There seems to be a bend toward negativity and divisiveness and certainly cynicism that there's never been worse days than these. And it's getting worse, Jimmy. So for those who have that view of their world and the world, what would you say to them?
Things are tough. They're challenging. And for many, more challenging than they've ever been. But there's also so much beauty still in the world and so much hope and so much joy and so many good things happening. If we look to see them, just passing a person and giving them a smile, finding that common humanity that we have within each other, it just gives, I think, can give us a little bit more hope. What's happening in the world is horrific. There are horrific things happening in the world, but we have to solve those problems. And the only way we can solve those problems is to come together, find that common humanity, and work toward solutions. Yes, things are pretty tough right now, but we have an endless, abundant opportunity and set of skills where we, if we put our minds to it and work together, we can come together and address these issues. One of the things I say in the book is that I totally reject this when people say, we're only as strong as our weakest link. As an engineer, I will tell you, especially as a structural engineer that studied strength of material and front center body cubics and all of the mathematical and technical aspects of what a chain and what metal are and what holds in a chain together, that all that works great for a chain. But that's a chain is not a society. In a society, we can make up for someone else's weaknesses with right. Our strengths. We can lift others up. We have an array of talents and skills that when combined together, we can do amazing things. I still remain hopeful because I know that as bad as things are right now, 100 years ago, they were worse. And I fully believe 100 years from now, they'll be better than they are today. And I believe that because of several reasons, because of the skills we have, the experiences we have, and the hope that lives within all of us, and the common humanity that we have, and then the fulcrum that holds us all together. And people can call it whatever they want to call it. I call it God. And that gives me hope and gives us all hope that we can overcome these things and build a better world as mankind has done since the beginning of civilization. This is the best time in the existence of civilization to be alive.
Yes. You know, a lot of our folks don't watch this video. They listen to the audio, and what they're missing is me nodding my head. And I'm not nodding to sleep. I'm nodding in agreement with our guests right now. So, Jimmy, listen, man, right on. This is an imperfect time. Welcome to life. But find me a place in history you'd rather be. Find me a place you'd rather live and go there. But I haven't yet. So I'm curious, you had an encounter with a fellow named Junior Higgins.
Yeah.
Tell me who Junior Higgins is and what he saw in some young, brash 20-year-old kid.
I went to work for Exxon straight out of college. And Exxon is this Byzantine organization with tremendous amount of rules that you have to follow because it's such a big organization. The bigger the organization, the more structure you need to be efficient. And so I understand it all. But the process for interviewing was you start with a campus interview and you have a 30-minute to 45-minute campus interview. And if the recruiter that's interviewing you is impressed enough with you, they'll invite you in for a visit. And then you interview with several more people during that visit. And then they decide whether or not they want to have you come to work for them. But it all starts with a 30 to 45 minute conversation on campus. I didn't have that conversation. I was sitting in the engineering library and I heard these guys talking about Exxon. And they say, you know, it's a really tough company. They come here, take our best students, work them to death, and then fire them. And I said, sounds interesting. Sounds like a challenge. I swung by my car, picked up a resume, and I went to the Career Placement Center, sought out the Exxon recruiter, and that was Junior Higgins. I said, I don't have time for an interview, but here's my resume. It lists my accomplishments and achievements, and it's got a contact number. So if you're interested, you can give me a call. So he took the resume. I was waiting for him to ask questions. He didn't ask any questions. He said, okay. So I thought that was the end of that. The next week, I got several letters inviting me for interviews at Exxon. As soon as I interviewed, I was hooked. The people were smart. The work was exciting and challenging. The ethics, just the level of integrity I saw. So I called all the other companies that had offered me jobs and said, I'm not interested anymore. And I canceled the rest of my interviews except for with other Exxon companies. Because at that point, I knew I'm sort of the type of guy that if you give me a menu at a restaurant, as soon as I find the item on the menu that I like, I don't even look at the rest of the menu. And so that was how I came to work for Exxon, was through Junior believing in me based upon just that interaction and breaking protocol, which is not something that happens at Exxon, but breaking protocol. And I would later ask Junior, I said, you didn't ask me any questions. Why was that? He said, well, I looked at your resume. It was impressive. I looked at you. You weren't. So I said, the only thing he can do is blow this.
That is not where I was expecting that to go. That is so awesome. And so, well, I'm glad in spite of your outfit and your unimpressiveness, he gave you a chance. It turned into almost a 3-decade-long career of impacting lives, being led and leading others. It also led to a chance encounter at an airport, DFW, John Grisham, and love. Tell me how all three of those things somehow braid together.
I was in Dallas. I was on a board for the National Society of Black Engineers, which is an organization that really promotes engineering education and getting opportunities in industry for African-American engineers. I had just read this book. I'm a numbers guy. And so the things I read were nerdy types of things. And a colleague finally had enough. And he literally brought into the office a bag of books, a brown grocery bag filled with novels, Grisham, Thoreau, Clancy. And the first book I pulled out and read was The Firm by Grisham. A couple of weeks later, I'm on a very early Sunday morning and headed to my gate at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport. And sitting at the gate was this lovely, beautiful young woman with her face in that same Grisham novel. And so it really wasn't much more at the time than, wow, she's reading the same book. The one book I've actually read recently that's not about Bureau of Labor Statistics or engineering equations and so we started talking about the book. Then we talked about what had us both in Dallas. She had grown up north of Dallas and was back for a wedding. She was at Michigan, at University of Michigan, getting her PhD. So we talked, we didn't even exchange names. We just talked and we boarded the plane. She happened to be in the seat, but the row behind me. I turned around maybe once or twice to see where she was in the book, to just, you know, talk about the book. And then we landed in Houston. I was going back to Houston. She told me that she was stopping over in Houston and was going to New York. And we parted. On the way to my car in the parking garage, I ran into a work colleague, and we had a very long conversation about work and so on and so forth. And then it occurred to me, you idiot. Why didn't you get her name? At least get her name. Fortunately, it was before 9/11. I turned around, went back into the airport, looked up the flight to New York. I saw a flight to LaGuardia. I went to the gate. She was not at that gate. And I said to myself, just thinking the way my brain works, it's a problem, solve it. Was she really going to New Jersey? Because Continental really flies a lot more to New Jersey than it does to LaGuardia. So let me check out Newark. And there was a flight for Newark. I find her at the gate. I find out that actually that flight had taxied out.
Oh, jeez.
Had an engine problem, came back to the gate and unboarded and deplaned. That was the only reason she was sitting there. But the first thing I said to her was, Newark is in New Jersey, not New York.
What a great pickup line. I'm sure it worked, Jimmy.
Yeah. And so that young lady, Erica, became my wife, and we have two great kids. So that's obviously a huge part of my life.
As I'm reading your books and listening to your other podcasts and just getting to know your life, so much of it is the audacity to step forward, having no real idea what's going to happen next. Like going back into the airport, running to LaGuardia, recognizing that, well, that's not the gate. So turning your attention to Newark, running there, seeing the plane coming back in, and then doing it again and again and again and again and again in life. As you hear that about your story, and we're about to shift gears into golf, so get ready for that. But as you look back in your life, how in awe are you of just how unlikely all of it is?
The first thing I'd say again is just going back to the discussion we were having about my mother, who taught us just to take life as it comes. And there's no sense of entitlement. There's no expectation. And so this is where I said earlier, this is where I think there's an intersection of your life and my life. First of all, I don't believe in coincidences. When you think about all these serendipitous encounters that I've had throughout my life and that we'll talk about with golf, I believe that fate intervenes for us. And I think that it's not a coincidence, actually, that our lives have intersected even. When I looked at your story, it was as challenging to get through your incident, that story, listening to Joe Buck narrate it, as it is for me to get through the audio portion of my brush with death. We were the same age, 9 years old. At 9, I did a very, very stupid thing. On a Friday evening, I tied a beach towel, a red beach towel around my shoulders, flipped it over my shoulders, tied it around my neck, fantasized about saving the world. I was a superhero. I was going to save the world. And after soaring above the imaginary clouds, I landed in the back of our house and crawled into a refrigerator, an old abandoned refrigerator, and closed the door, thinking that if I could pull it open from the outside, I'd be able to push it open from the inside. I was living out this episode that I'd read as a younger kid, or seen on television, Superman being locked in a safe, dropped to the bottom of the ocean, and he breaks out and he continues to be Superman.
Yeah.
The problem was when I tried to open the door and I pushed, nothing happened. I'm starting to sweating. I'm gasping for air. And I finally come to the realization that at 9 years old, all the dreams I'd had for my life were ending right then and there, that this was it for me. The one place I found peace and solace was my grandparents had taught us that all kids who die before 12 go to heaven. I found peace and accepted that I was going to die and I was going to go to heaven. My life was over. And you had an actual voice, the voice of Jack Buck. And I heard a voice, but the voice was coming from inside my head, telling me not to quit, to not give up. And I can't explain it, but I just know in my even more weakened state, I pushed with all I had, with my arms, my little skinny arms and my skinny legs against that door. And it finally just, it came open. So for me, literally, every breath I take, every moment my heart beats is a gift, a true gift. For me, not only was life a gift, I am grateful that the mother who loved me so dearly and the father who never knew me gave me life. Because giving me life gave me a chance. And coming out of that refrigerator, it gave me a chance. And I don't know, John, if you experience this same thing, but it also for me created a debt that I felt that I needed to repay, that there has to be purpose, there has to be meaning, that there's a reason for me to meet the people that I meet. There's a reason for our lives to interact, for us to help each other, to make life better. That's a part of what drives a lot of what I do. I cannot explain from a technical standpoint with all my engineering training, and I cannot explain how that door came open. I just know it did. So there are a lot of things that happen that I cannot explain. I just know they happen. I just perpetually believe that there's always a way. We just have to find it.
I'm glad you found the way. And I'm glad that door opened up. And I'm glad you brought us back in time and shared that story with us. It's one more remarkable story of your life. And I'm glad that you kept breathing. I'm glad that you're grateful for each breath that you've got. And then I'm glad you eventually discovered a game called golf. And I'm shocked that this guy who discovered golf decided one day, you know what? I don't want to just play golf. I want to play a lot of golf. I want to play all over the country golf. I want to play the top 100 courses in the United States in 1 year, something that no one else had ever done ever. Talk to me first about where did your love of golf originate, and then shift gears into, and why play 100 of the best golf courses in 1 year?
I admired golf because it did seem hard, but it seemed too hard. And it's also could be very, very expensive. So I sort of in the back of my mind, I'd always wanted to play golf. And I remember being fascinated by an interview that I saw of Jack Nicklaus when I was probably about 10 to 12 years old, somewhere in that range. And it was just fascinating. I would see guys at the park, black guys at the black park in the segregated, that by then we'd moved to the Gulf Coast near Galveston and segregated towns and the segregated park. In the black neighborhood, there was a park. These guys in an open field were just hitting, swinging a club and hitting the ball. So there was no target. They were just hitting balls. And then I heard Jack Nicklaus talk about the ball going to a particular place. I'm like, I thought you were just supposed to hit him.
Yeah.
You're really trying to make this ball go to a particular place. And that really fascinated me from a lot of aspects. But I never really took up the game. And I'm going to paraphrase just a little bit. But at dinner one night, as I was getting a new work assignment, we were in Virginia at what was ExxonMobil's headquarters. We merged with Mobil by this time. At dinner one night, the vice president of my division says, Jimmy, you're going back to Texas. And if you want to get along, this is the paraphrasing part, but if you want to get along with the folks you're working with and who'll be working for you, you need to start shooting something. You can shoot animals or you can shoot par. You choose, but pick one. My wife chose. She purchased a set of golf clubs for me and a set of lessons, golf lessons for me. And it was hard. Just to hit the ball was hard. And then it was at night at a lesson, and I struck the ball and it soared into the sky above the lights and just into the distant sky. And that just amazing feeling of, wow, I did that. And then it's like, how do I do that again? And then golf becomes this pursuit of that perfect shot again. I'm just fascinated by what it takes to hit a pure golf shot. And it's so rare for me, but I just fell in love with the game. I came to it late. I was 45 years old, but I went at it with the approach of a zealot that just fell in love with it. There's a piece of it that I'm sure that goes back to my childhood, where I would go to my out in the country where my grandparents lived and just roam through the prairies and the fields and just felt so free. And it was just getting in touch with nature. Mm-hmm. Being out in nature on a golf course, I feel like I'm home. That's the appeal. Now, you ask about playing the top 100 courses. As I decided to retire, my job was intense. I ran operations around the world for the company and for the corporation, and I traveled a lot and spent a lot of time away from home. That meant I missed so much of our kids. We have two kids, Jordan and Alexandra. I missed so much of their early years. And so I wanted to retire early so that I could be home during their high school years. But I also knew that I couldn't go from working at a 100-mile-an-hour pace job to an idle retirement. So I needed a project. I needed to create a new relevance, a new sense of something at something I'd never done before. Initially, I said, I'll just travel around the country. When I was younger and had more free time too, I would travel across the country, meeting people, talking with people, just connecting with our country. And I wanted that sense that I was sort of a little nostalgic for that again. And I said, so I'll play golf in every state, two courses in every state, one with strangers and one with friends. And that'll help me transition from my career to retirement. But before I could do that, my wife gave me a book by this guy, John Sabino, who had played golf around the world, played the top 100 courses around the world. He did it over a lifetime. And so I didn't really understand. I'm thinking numbers. I'm going to play 100 courses. So it's like, why not just play the top 100, the 100 best? So Golf Digest comes out with their list a couple of months later. I look at the list. I probably recognized about, at most, 40 of the courses. The rest of them I'd never heard of. But I said, I guess this is it. This is what I'm going to do. And I then said, I wonder, 87 of the courses were private. 12 are resort courses and one public course. And so I had this idea, is America still the type of country where that grit and determination I had as a kid to overcome racism and poverty and all those people along the way that helped me achieve my dreams, can that same thing happen as an adult traveling across the country? We're a country still where people are kind enough, enthused enough, generous enough to help a stranger achieve a dream. And I said, I'll see. I'm going to see if I can gain access to all these courses without ever asking. And it wasn't really about golf. It was more about us as a country and my belief in the American dream and my belief in us as a country. And one of the things I want to say that I didn't say earlier, my mother was not perfect by any means, but we loved her fiercely. Mm. We loved her dearly. We admired her. Our country isn't perfect, but it doesn't have to be. It's up to us to make it better every day by working to make it better every day. Just like my mother wasn't perfect, but I loved her. I love my country. And I think that we can make it a better country by working together every day to make it a better country. It's nobody else's responsibility to make it a better country but ours. And so I wanted to get that sense and reconnect with the country. And I found the country conflicting. There was good, there was bad, there was hopefulness, there was resentment, there were all of these things. But in the end, all these strangers, out of just kindness and generosity, without me asking, just me telling them of a dream, got sucked into that dream And just like I looked for ways to get from A to B, they started looking for ways to get me from A to B.
It's just some of the stories you shared about them leaving their family, them hopping on planes to help you out.
Yes.
These aren't your brothers, man. These aren't your best buddies. These are guys who've never met you, and yet they're all in on your dream.
Yes.
What? So I'm curious, in reading that, what struck me is why. What was it about your desire to play their fancy course that had them leave a family obligation four states away to travel on a red eye to meet you at the tee at 7:30 in the morning? Why would they do that?
I wish that I could answer that question beyond the obvious, and that is, at our core, we're kind, generous people seeking purpose. And when we can do something to help another, it is as much a gift to us as it is to them. And that was brought home to me by this guy, Sergio Galvez.
Yeah.
I was playing golf at the ocean course at Kiowa Island before I started on the quest. And this guy I was playing with, he asked me what I did. And I told him I was about to retire and I was going to play the top 100 courses in the country in a year. And he says, Maidstone is one of those courses, isn't it? And I said, yeah, this guy, Jeff Wellen, was an executive with AMC. And he says, I went to school with this woman whose husband is a member at Maidstone. I'm going to tell him about what you're doing, and I'm sure he'll invite us to come and play. He did. Sergio invited us, and we played. And over dinner, Sergio asked the exact same question you just asked. Before I could answer, Jeff answered, said, because it's a fascinating thing and people just want to be a part of it. And Sergio said, yeah, I would agree with that, but I think there's something more to it than that, that there's something deeper there. And so I said, Sergio, you're a stranger. You didn't know me. And yet you drove up from the city today through all that traffic to get here out on the eastern end of Long Island to host me, a stranger. Why? And Sergio's response was that it was as much a gift to him as it was to me. And that allowing people to feel good about what they're able to do for someone else that's so enthusiastic about what they're doing is a gift. And I hadn't thought about it that way then, but it came home to me with that discussion with Sergio.
So this morning, you were kind of the center of my team meeting. We talked about our lives and our work for the week and everything else, but I talked about this episode I was recording today with you. And one of the colleagues that I work with said, it doesn't sound that hard, 365 days, 100 courses, and just kind of doing the paper napkin math. It's not that hard. And I think that does not take into context at all how difficult the game of golf is over time, how difficult travel is, how unreliable weather is, and others are, and cars are, and planes are, and life is. And yet you pushed through, man, and you accomplished what previously had been unaccomplished. And some thought unaccomplishable. It's really a difficult thing to play all these private courses in 33 different states and time zones and financially and everything else. So as you look back on that year of all these courses and all those swings, all those mulligans, don't kid yourself, what was the hardest part of all of it?
Just what you said, to put it in context, if someone was to actually say to you, John, over the next year, I'd like you to travel to 100 different places and have a cup of coffee at Starbucks. That would actually be, to the average person, a very daunting task to set up the travel, even the hotels, the rental cars, just to go to a Starbucks and have coffee. Now throw into that mix that you have to get access to the most exclusive golf clubs in the country. That in itself is a huge challenge. Okay, now you throw in the fact that one of my trips, 12 hours before it was time to take off from Atlanta to get to San Francisco, the Atlanta airport shut down completely. It lost its primary power supply and its backup power supply. Forget about the fact that when I was in California, Los Angeles, to play golf at three courses, this flood comes in and washes away a part of the golf course and takes with it 23 lives. Forget about the fact that one course wildfires came within a few yards of the structures and the cores, and then went around it and burned everything else on the other side of it down. The hurricanes that year, just you add in all of the things that are just the normal process of life, and it becomes potentially a lot more daunting than the math, than the vision.
So. And back pains.
Back pains.
Oh, running out of gas, or nearly running out of gas, and challenge after challenge after challenge. As you look back on it, and you can't say the entire thing, give me one highlight. What was the moment where you looked around and you're like, oh my gosh, I cannot believe that I get to spend my day doing this right here, right now?
But there were several highlights, and I can't get, it's hard to do one, but being at Augusta National, standing on that first tee at Augusta National, but there are times when it was as simple as just sitting, talking to the locker room attendant at Sahali, just north of Seattle, and this stranger and I having this great conversation, or when I played at Kinloch, and I'm a 58-year-old Black man with a 21-year-old caddy from Virginia Tech, and this kid and I just bond, and it's just the two of us on the golf course together. People ask me, what do you take away from it, from golf, about golf? The unifying nature of golf, how people from disparate lives can come together, and over a four-hour period, the common passion for golf, the heat from that common passion just melts away all differences, and you're connected. Those are the highlights. Just the people I met, whether it was a guard at the gate telling me to stay out of the bunkers, or the guard at the gate at Pine Valley saying, just have fun. Those moments, it always really evolves around people and the interaction with people throughout the journey.
You mentioned it. It struck me when you said it. You used to love going out to your grandparents to run around in the hills. They had some land, rural area. Their grandparents were enslaved.
Yes.
And here you are playing at Augusta, which until a couple decades ago did not even let a Black person play. And you get to tee off as if you are worthy, like everyone else, of teeing off and then following your ball and hitting the second shot and then the third and dropping it into the pen, picking it up and going to the second hole. That progression from what your grandparents' grandparents endured to what you've been able to experience is mind-blowing.
I talk about standing on that first tee at Augusta National, and I reflect back upon playing baseball with a stick in a doll's head in the dirt. I talk about going to our fly-infested outhouses, the stink we bore. I was born into a world, literally born into a world that lacked almost everything. And I'm at Augusta National, a world that lacks almost nothing. Trying to close that gap, it's just unimaginable how to span that gap. Another one that I would tell you about, we talk about slavery. There are two top 100 courses in Texas, one in Dallas, Dallas National, and the other is Whispering Pines. It's 20 minutes from the spot where the tobacco plantation was, where my great-great-grandparents met. 20 minutes. I'm playing golf 20 minutes from where my ancestors were slaves. They could not have imagined what leisure was. And yet I'm doing this leisure thing just 20 miles away from where they had toiled as slaves and endured the injustices of slavery. You could look at that many ways. I look at it as they built the foundation for what gives us the strength to make this even a better world. Mm-hmm. They endured what they endured. We have to honor them by making this a better world.
So final question before we shift into the Live Inspired 7 for my new friend who we're wrapping up 17. We're about to move on to 18 together. For those who are feeling as if they're enduring a very difficult, very unfair world in their life right now, and they're just beat down by it, what would be your encouragement to them?
That how they feel is how they feel, and what they're enduring is what they're enduring. The thing that I would say to all of us, though, is that we all face challenges. And to every single one of us, whatever that challenge is, it's daunting. And my challenge is irrelevant when it comes to your challenge. because I'm not going through what you're going through. So it doesn't matter whether it's daunting to me. It matters that it's daunting to the person who's going through it. And for all of us, hold on to the hope that there is a way. You know, there's one part I talk about, this story where we took our kids to the Martin Luther King Memorial, the new one in Washington, D.C. And our son was looking at the statue of Dr. King. And then there are these rocks behind him. And there was the narrowest of gaps between those rocks. And he read the words and he looked at that narrow gap and he said, wow, they didn't have a lot of hope, did they? Because the gap was so narrow. And I said to him, just enough to change the world. And for those that are going through so much right now, just like when I was in that refrigerator, when you were lying in that hospital bed, when it seems like all hope is lost, hang on. Hang on, because around that next corner, that next instant, that next moment can be salvation.
Jimmy, as we wrap up this trip around the course together, man, it's been an honor. And the book was beautiful. Your heart is beautiful. You're the legacy of your mother and her parents and their parents. It's unbelievable, the journey that you continue forward, man. So as we wrap up, we call these the questions of the Live Inspired Seven. There's seven questions that tether all of our guests together. So my friend, get ready. Question number one is, what's been the most impactful book you've ever read?
Well, the Bible is the most impactful book I've ever read. Beyond the Bible, I'd say Flow by Mihaly.
So we've heard Flow before on the podcast, and we've heard the Bible, as you might imagine, a couple times on the podcast. When someone says a book that took, 1,300 years or so to write and has various authors within it, what's your favorite book within the Bible?
Joshua 1:8. This book should not pass out of the mouth, but you shall meditate therein day and night, that you may be careful to do according to all that is written within. For then you shall have life and you shall prosper.
What is one positive characteristic or one trait that you possess as a little kid growing up in East Texas that you wish you exhibited as much today?
The fascination and splendor of even the most simplest of things. I get a little nostalgic for how simple, as tough as life was, there was just this peace in the simplicity of it all. I'd like to just simplify life again and just have that amazing, when you see something new, when you experience something new, that awe and wonder that comes from the new experiences. I'd love to continue to be able to see the magic that I saw as a six-year-old.
Yeah, a lot of folks aren't seeing it now because their arms are crossed and they're looking down rather than having their hearts lit up with a red little cape around their neck like you had as a boy, looking up. So I know you had it. I think you still have it. So question number three is, if your home caught fire, your two children are out, your bride, Erica, is out, the animals are out, you have an opportunity of running and grabbing one item. What's that one physical thing you would come outside with safely?
Probably the hard drive of the computer that has all the memories and photographs of the experiences that we've shared as a family.
If you could sit on a bench on a gorgeous day and have a long conversation with anyone living or deceased, who would you like to be next to?
Probably Dr. King. I'd ask him, how in the midst of such a storm were you able to find that hope? And how can I express to others how it's there? And we have to find it and create it in ourselves. Just the dream that he had and the strength and the courage. I think I'd learned so much from him.
We've had his son, Martin III, on our podcast, and being able to visit with this man and his wife, it was awesome. And you hear undertones, as you would, the parents' love continues on in their child. So it was amazing to hear his father speak so beautifully through him. Amazing story. What's the best advice that Martin Luther King Jr., your mother, or anybody else ever gave you? So the best advice you've ever received, Jimmy, is?
Always make the best move.
What does that mean to you?
Figure out the best thing to do and do it. And if you can't do it in the right way, figure out the best thing that you could do closest to the right way and do it. And that really comes from advice that my mother lived. And it was, I learned it also through chess. When you're playing chess, you could come up with all sorts of moves. And if your opponent doesn't catch it, you may win. But really, if you had never want to lose a chess match, always figure out what the best move is and then make it. Once you figure out the right thing to do, there should be no question about doing it. The only other component is, how do I do it in the right way?
What advice would you give yourself at age 20?
Don't fret the small stuff, because at the end of the day, what really matters, what endures, is what we actually do for others. What we do for ourselves, and I have that quote in the book, what we do for ourselves, it really does die with us. What we do for others lives on. It's more important, I think, to focus on that.
Jimmy, you're about to putt in from 2 inches out. So, buddy, here we go. It has been said that all great people can have their lives summed up in one sentence. How would you like yours to read?
He never quit, never settle for average.
Jimmy James, author of Playing from the Rough, brother, husband, father, golf maniac, and a vibrant example of living large for others. It has been an honor having you on our episode, having you talk with us at Live Inspired, and you are a beautiful model of what it looks like to never quit.
Thank you. Thank you again for the opportunity to share my story. And the last thing I would say to you, John, my mother, who again raised 8 kids to be healthy, productive contributors to society, her monument is the lives that we live. And honoring her, the sacrifices she made, we are her monuments.
8 beautiful monuments. And man, it's an honor being with one of them right now. So thank you for that. Thank you for the challenge, because I also recognize as one of 6 in my family that that's our job, to be living monuments to our beautiful parents. So again, Jimmy, I look forward to our next visits for this time. And until next time, my name is John O'Leary. That is Jimmy James, author of Playing from the Rough. Today is your day, my friends. Live inspired.
Well, my friends, I told you as we began the course today that this thing was going to be about something far bigger, far more important even than golf. This was about reconciliation. This was about family. This was about changing the trajectory of our life generationally. This was about recognizing, regardless of where we've come from and the mistakes we make, that we can redefine what is possible, that we can step forward boldly toward it, and that indeed the best is yet to come. What a beautiful story Jimmy James leads. Man, I'm grateful that he shared it with us. If you enjoyed sharing this time with me as much as I enjoyed bringing it to you, do me a favor. Tell those you work with, worship with, work out with, do life with, that you tune in to the Live Inspired podcast, and so should they. It's a great way that we can get this message out to even additional lives going forward. 2 more things you can do. So here comes 1. One of the things that made it so clear to me of what allowed Jimmy to become the success that he did is his beautiful mother. So many of our guests celebrate their mom, and I'm one of those individuals who celebrated mine. So if you want to learn more about my mother's story and my relationship with her, you can check that out at the very first episode ever recorded here at Live Inspired. It's episode 000. That's where you'll hear the amazing story and the amazing voice, the amazing life of my hero, Susan O'Leary. I love her. That's one thing you can do. Check out episode 000 with my mom. Another thing you can do is you can join me to write a meaningful, significant, well-written love letter. That's right. We're going to be meeting on May 5th at 4:00 Central Standard Time, and I would love for you to join us in identifying one individual that needs to hear your heart, your ideas, your love, your wisdom. I'm bringing on my friend, his name is Blake Brewer, to guide us through this exercise. It is free, but you've got to register. So join me online right now at www.johnoleryinspires.com/together. We'll have a link there so you can join us on May 5th at 4:00 Central Standard Time to write that meaningful letter to one person in your life. Trust me, my friends, it will be worth it. Can't wait to see you there. So until then, my name is John O'Leary. I'm grateful that you are part of our Live Inspired podcast movement. So for this time, and until next time, this is John. Today is your day. What a gift. Live inspired.
You know that Keeley Companies is all about fostering the world-class culture through their incredible cultural pillars. Well, it was time to add a seventh cultural pillar, Keeley Green. Guided by the mission to raise the sustainability standards by which they design, build, operate, and live, Keeley Green is dedicated to using a holistic approach to leave a positive impact on our environment, create a future that is sustainable for generations to come. In the words of Rusty Keeley, we are just getting started. You can learn more about that just getting started mentality and all the work they do by visiting my friends at Keeley Companies online at keeleycompanies.com.